This M2M podcast, which is a production of Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV show, is your window into what we're doing. So if you listen to us, thank you. If you know somebody that wants to know a little bit more about what goes on our show and the stories coming up and likes behind-the-scenes information, tell them about it. This week, we are going to introduce you to a new analyst that is going to join us in the month of November of 2020. His name is Chris Robinson, and he is with the Robinson Review. And you're like, yeah, but he's been on your show before. You are right. He did appear on Market to Market one time previously. We'll get into how that happened and his background. Growing up in the state of Pennsylvania, we'll dive into his background, and you're going to want to hear about one of his favorite places as a college athlete, where it was that he liked to play football. So there's a tease. He is a former college football player, but why did Chris get into trading commodities? We're going to talk a lot about options and understanding calls and puts and why those are tools in the toolbox and what's been good for customers and why Chris is gone into that. That is the installment here on the M2M podcast. I'm Paul Yeager. Thank you so very much for joining us and enjoy this discussion with Chris Robinson. Man, you look good in a tie. Does it feel weird to be wearing a tie?
Yeah, it does. It does, actually.
You go for so long. I mean, I'm wearing a tie once a week now. In fact, I'm in a sweatshirt today, and I've really gotten used to that. You're still staring at screens no matter what it is. But in your years, Chris, you can't duplicate. There's never been a time like this to do what you do. Has there?
No, not really. I mean, it's, you know, I've made the transition too. I went from being on the floor for 18 years to then being in an office and working with farmers, you know, obviously over the phone. But even then, when you're in that an office with, you know, a half dozen or another dozen guys or more, or guys and gals, you know, it's you miss that camaraderie, you miss that discussion that, you know, around the markets. And, you know, I'll say this, 90% of the people that are, you know, in the hedging business or in the brokerage business, most of them at this point, they're there because they really enjoy the markets. So yeah, I do miss that. It's been an interesting year. You know, when they told us in St. Paddy's Day that it was just going to be 2 weeks and we'd all be back, I had a sneaking feeling that, you know, we might be out a little bit longer, and lo and behold, here we are. So it's been a difficult, especially if you had a routine, you know, we're going downtown and, you know, being with people, but like everything else, you adapt. There's the plus side of it is you can, pretty much handle any business from anywhere. So you're never really out of touch. And I, you know, I've gotten to the point now where I'll talk to somebody, they can call me any time of the day, almost, as long as it's, you know, before about 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night. So there's a plus there as well. More chance to talk to customers and clients if they need to.
Well, yeah, it's no different than when you would go out on the road, say you were speaking in Topeka, you'd be sitting there at the Hilton or the, you know, the Holiday Inn. It's no different. It just now happens to be one of the rooms in your house.
Right.
Yeah. So, you mentioned the time on the floor. Is that where you started?
Yeah. You know, I came out to, Chicago really, kind of on accident. I had a friend of mine that had a brother that was in the ag room. And at the time, I was kind of thinking about going to law school, but I already graduated and worked for about a year doing different things. And literally, I stepped on the floor in Chicago. And, you know, I think a half hour later, I had a job. 2 days later, I went back home. I grew up outside Pittsburgh, West Pennsylvania. I went home and 2 days later, I was back on the floor. So it was just one of those things where, for my personality, when I stepped on the floor, it was perfect for me. It was like heaven. So I really enjoyed those years on the floor and started out as a phone clerk and a runner and did a lot of different things, did some brokerage. Then about 2.5 years in, I had some guys that had taught me what they knew and helped me get going in the business. And I started trading, I think in 1992 is when I got my first seat. And then, you know, that was it. That was the beginning of my career. And I was on the floor until 2010. You know, the floor did close a few years ago, but really 08, 09 is really when the business model changed. And I was in my early 40s at the time. And I was like, well, I think it's time to change with, you know, you could see the writing was on the wall, unfortunately.
the computers and the algos were already kind of making the humans archaic.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, what had been a benefit to be on the floor, because that's where all the information was, and obviously you were at the tip of the spear, right? Every bid and every offer was in the pit. When it's moved to the screen, it was a difficult transition because that was a completely different world. And so all the things that helped you be a good floor trader really had no bearing at all once you were trading from the screen. So two things happened to that. I learned a lot more about options because just going from being a pure futures trader to using options occasionally in front of reports for defensive measures and stuff like that. I learned a lot more about options and also learned a lot more about really how the tools that are there in the futures and options can really help somebody's bottom line. You know, so when I got into the hedging business, I actually, after about a year of it, I wish I'd gotten into it early because it was really the first time in my life where it was a good feeling to be able to help somebody. If the market moved against them and you had a hedge on for them and you could send them back a check because their hedge worked, that to me was a good feeling. So I was happy that I made the change from, you know, being a full-time trader to getting into brokerage and risk management.
How do you best explain that to someone that a risk, a call, a put? We'll get into that in a moment.
Yeah.
About what that means for you and me. But how do you best explain the call, the put, and why the option's important?
Well, you know, everybody
or something to do. I shouldn't say right. It's important. It's something to do.
Right. Well, it is. The whole reason that building was built 165 years ago, whatever it was, is because literally, if you study the history, you know, a farmer would get there. If he got there on Tuesday with his family, they got a good price for their wheat and corn, right? If they got there a week or 10 days late, sometimes they would get, you know, pennies on the dollar. And that's why there are a lot of stories where people get so mad they would just dump their grain in Lake Michigan, right? And that's, you know, this whole business model arose because people needed that. They recognized that you can't have somebody, you know, and this is back in, you know, before 1930, 85% of the country was engaged in ags, right? So it was the number one risk that most people had. And so that's why that building exists. And then you obviously, because Chicago was the center of the hub for all the railroads, because everything came in there and then became a processing plant for the livestock as well. So really that, if they hadn't created the futures contract, then, you know, at some point somebody would have come up with, because really people recognize that If you've got a product cycle which takes you 8 months from start to finish, and you don't really have a good idea what the supply demand is going to be when you go to sell your product, you needed to have some mechanism to lay your risk off. And really, that's what it really became. It was really the first derivative market where somebody could say, okay, if you promise me you'll honor this contract, a year from now, you'll buy my grain from, you'll buy my corn from me at $4 a bushel. And that doesn't sound like such a great thing until the year comes around and corn's at a dollar and you've contracted it at four. And not only have you contracted it at four, but somebody was there that honored their previous decision to buy it from you at four. That was the other thing too. So you had to have the standardized contract. You had to have the means to enforce that contract, so somebody didn't walk away from, you know, an agreement they had made. And that was really the whole beauty of that, the system was that, based on the information we have today, somebody would reach out 6 months or a year or 2 years out and say, okay, I'll guarantee you that price. And that really changed, you know, the marketing opportunities for, you know, anybody that was involved in ags.
That's like 90 years ago. And today we still have people who are harvesting a corn or a soybean or a wheat crop who aren't taking part in any of that, and they sell it off the combine or they drive it back to the home place from the 80, put it in a bin, and they might pull it out in March. They might pull it out in July.
Mm-hmm.
You would have thought time would have allowed us to feel more comfortable with that. Why are some people hesitant to dip their toe into that?
Well, I think it's based on what you learned growing up. I mean, I was born in 1966, so I'm 54 years old, so you know, there's been a sea change. Certainly anybody that was my generation or older, if they had been taught by their parents and their grandparents, don't sell it till it's in the bin, don't worry about it. And if you build yourself, if you could build yourself storage on property, they looked at that storage bin as like basically like a gigantic wallet. It's like, no matter what, nobody's coming to taking that from me. We'll hold on to it. Worst case scenario, we'll eat it ourselves. Right. So it was that mindset, I think, for, 150 years. And I think there's, like everything else in life, there's resistance to change. Number one. Number two, if somebody did dip their toe into hedging and didn't have a good experience with it, that could be anything, fill in the blank, but had a bad experience with it, where they lost money and they didn't understand what happened, or they took a position on that ended up really hurting them, right? The horror story out there you hear about, somebody says, all right, I'm going to sell my corn at $4, and then they don't grow it, and then corn goes to $8, they got a problem, right? So those are the stories there where people say, well, there's reasons not to do it. And lots of times in life, like everything else, all it takes is one or two horror stories and you're like, yep, that's not for me. I'm never going to do it. And so people stay away from it. So it's like everything else. Using a futures contract or using a put or a call, it's a tool. And sometimes when you use a tool properly, it can really help you. But a tool in the wrong hands can cause some trouble too. So I think that's it. And I also think the other thing is it's you have to educate yourself, or you have to commit to teaching yourself to really understand it. Because if you're not familiar with it, you'll always have a sneaking position in the back of your mind that somehow it's not going to work, or somehow you're being taken advantage of somehow by doing it. So there's a lot of reasons not to do it. And also the other thing is, if you can get by without doing anything, that's what most people would like to do. So I think that's the answer to your question. It's a long way to go, but sometimes people will choose to do nothing, even if it means that they miss opportunities.
And mate, they say, well, I don't want to pay that 10 cents, or I don't want to pay, well, you lost $1.15. So why was that dime such a problem? And the reason I say it that way, and we're avoiding something here. I want to get into your home in a minute, but I need to get back into your career before we get back into Pennsylvania.
Okay.
You're on the floor, you work for a couple of different companies, and then you end up at Top Third, and you end up with right. Mark Gold, and working with Mark. And Mark is the guy that we always, anytime we tweet, he's coming. Oh, the calls and puts guy. They know him as that.
Right.
How much did you know about calls and puts before Mark, and what did he do to kind of educate, maybe give you something different to think about? Or is he just, no, we synced up on the way we think about how that can be a tool used to help somebody?
Well, Mark's a great gentleman, a great guy. He's one of the first people, because I showed up on the floor really without a whole lot of connections on the floor. I didn't know a lot of anybody, didn't grow up in Chicago. And when I stepped into the soybean pit by myself, nobody knew who I was. A lot of people didn't want to talk to me. I was 23, 24 years old with a crew cut. A lot of people looked at me like, who is this guy? What's he doing here? And Mark was one of the first people that shook my hand and talked to me and really pointed out quite a few things to me that I used. And when I met him, he was a broker and a trader, but he was filling paper. So he also, just from standing next to him or within 3 or 4 feet of him, I got to know a lot from him just, through osmosis. So he was a friend of mine. We actually went our separate ways halfway into it. Mark in his younger days when he left the floor, he's a few years older than me, but he left the floor way before I did and actually got into the hedging business. But I always kept in touch with him. And, every couple of years we get together and talk. So yeah, he did, really educate me, as to exactly how, a program should be designed to help a farmer make better sales. That's really what it is. The name of his company, it was Top Third. He wasn't trying to sell the high. He was trying to, get you marketed in the Top Third. And I was there for 10 years, 11 years. It was a good experience and, certainly learned a lot while I was there as well. And I think it was another thing that, experience I learned were, a good marketing plan. What does that mean? There's two ways to try and to market. Either you hold it till you think you know where the high is, or you're always trying to pick your spot, right? The nice thing about a marketing plan is it can help even out the highs and lows. When prices get good, if you're willing to, pay the insurance premium, basically what it is for that put option, which is a substitute sale. You can capture that price for a certain amount of time and you sleep better at night. Same thing. If we have a rally and it hits your level at $4, but you're scared to sell it because you think it might go to five. Well, if you make the cash sale, you can stay in the game, but with a call option. So those three things together, really making a good cash sale, being able to take advantage of price rallies when they happen, even if you don't want to sell it. If it's too early for you to sell it, you need to get your risk on paper. And, you know, I think I was there for about 6 months or a year before it really clicked for me, where I said, okay, now I understand it. And then I spent the last 10, 11 years explaining that to people over the phone, which can be, a learning experience in itself. So at the end of the day, like everything else in life, you can make things very, very complicated, or you can keep them very, very simple. I think when somebody is new to hedging or understanding how to use futures and options, it's always better to start out on the simple level. You can always, quite a few different things you can do with puts and calls. But at the end of the day, I think if we could get 80% of the farmers or 90% of the farmers in America to understand that, hey, this is when you use a put and this is when you use a call, I think that would be, you'd have a lot better outcome for a lot of farmers in the U.S.
Well, and you got to admit to the producer and say, hey, this is what your opponent is using against you, or they're using it too. There's no rule. I've got a big book here. There's no rule that says you can't use it too. I mean, and you have to, because when we talk about the funds, or you talk about, the money or what, whatever it is, that's what they're using. And no, they're using it against you. So why don't you use it against them? I mean, it's America. You got to be competitive with each other.
Right. You have to understand it. And if you don't, the last thing you want to do is get involved with something you don't understand. So like everything else in life, you need to educate yourself, because at the end of the day, no matter if you've got a good advisor or your own advisor, you've got to be comfortable with how you're hedging your risk. And that's really what it comes down to. And some farmers, producers, they don't want anything to do with it, which is fine. Other people, I think it comes down to a generational thing. Somebody that was maybe, 50 or younger, they're more comfortable with it, because they really didn't start having options on the futures market till, the late 70s, early 80s, so that was really something that even the Board of Trade missed for a long, long time. For years, it was just, you just had to use futures and good luck with you, because you better be ready to make margin calls if the market moves against you. The beauty about options, puts and calls, is that if you use them properly, and by properly, I mean, you understand how you're doing it. When you buy an option, a put or a call, the day you buy it, that's the most money you can lose. I think that's point number one for people to understand, that if you just buy a put or buy a call, 3 days later, 3 months later, however long you've got that position on, nobody's calling you up saying, hey, you got to send in more money. So right there, that's why it can appeal to a lot of producers, because it doesn't take a daily checking in. What's that position doing? What's that position doing? So, so I think in general, you're right. And when you talk about who you're competing against, the whole world really, even in the last 10, 15 years, when we got more computerized, there really is a large impact felt by the managed money. And people say, what are the managed money? Well, the CTFC, they break it down. These people have to report their positions every week. That's one thing that we look at. You can see, courtesy of the CFTC, the way these guys are bet. I mean, it's really a key tool to have. So people always, I've had even people ask me, well, how do you know that information? Well, it's published by the CTFC. So every week, they'll tell you where the big money is. And why do you want to know that? Well, I always kind of use the analogy of like surfing or something like that, where, if there's a big wave out there that could come get you, you want to be looking to see what that wave's doing. And that's really what it comes down to now. And sometimes, they're your friend, right? If you're a farmer or producer, you're always long, right? So you're always a bull. So when the funds are long, they're your buddies, right? Where people really don't like the funds is when the markets are going down. And that's the one thing that the funds, the professional traders, don't do, is they don't ride a loser. they will, if they're long, they will sell it till they're out. And I think that's another thing too. All these markets, you know, it takes 3, 4, 5 months to rally a dollar and you lose half of it in a week, right? That's the thing. It always goes up the escalator. And when it corrects, it goes down the elevator shaft. And, you know, a lot of people spend all their time trying to say, well, when is the correction coming? When is the correction coming? And, you know, not to circle back to that, but that's one thing nice about using a put option to protect yourself. Once it gets to your price, if you set it and forget it, you can kind of ease up on watching, you know, when's the correction going to come. And it lets you keep the upside open and not be so stressed about waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning and seeing, well, where's corn right now and stuff like that. So
yeah. What's the overnight? What's the overnight? Yeah. And I think, did you write about that this week about saying, you know, if you're not paying attention to the overnights, you're missing out on a whole bunch. Explain that to me.
Yeah. I mean, when you wake up in the morning, lots of times the market's still trading into 7 o'clock in the morning. And then there's that half hour break. So you may wake up and say, well, you know, what happened overnight? And we've seen that in the last 2 months. Ironically, a lot of this rally started coming out of something called Malaysian palm oil, which is just edible oil over there. They had a big shortage. They still have a shortage. Malaysian palm oil went from 4 or 5 year lows to we're at 8 year highs. And we did that in 2 months. It's part of the reason that you've had such a big move in soybeans as well, as people catch up to that demand. And that's why I've always, you know, that's one of the things I've started doing when I was actually trading for myself years ago, was pay attention to the overnight markets, because it impacts what happens during the day. And that's something that I've always watched and continue to watch. These markets are all interrelated right now, because again, we talked about the funds earlier. Most of these people that are trading the funds, they really don't care about supply and demand. What they're trading is the price. And they would just as soon trade corn if corn's moving as they would trade Amazon. All they're trying to do is catch the move and make money, catch the trend. So I think that that's a reason that you need to pay attention to what's going on in the overnight markets.
You said grew up in Pennsylvania. You said mm-hmm. West Pennsylvania, is that what you said?
Right outside Pittsburgh.
Yeah. So Western then what was life like as a kid? What were you on the farm? Were you in the city, in between?
It was in between. Actually, grandparents and everybody up until my mom and dad's generation, they had actually been on the farm in Virginia, around Manassas, Virginia. All my uncles and my father, after World War II, they were the first people in their generation to get off the farm and go to college. My two uncles, one was an engineer, one worked for TWA, and my dad worked for U.S. Steel. But they were the first generation that didn't do anything on the farm. My grandfather had been on the farm, and they continued to own it. I think 10, 12, 15 years ago, they subdivided it up and finally got rid of it. But that was, you know, sort of the roots from my family, right outside Manassas, Virginia, kind of not that far from Washington, D.C. And so I grew up in Pittsburgh, Western Pennsylvania. My thing growing up was I was the last child, kind of the whoops baby. So my parents were just like, as long as you stay out of trouble, you can pretty much do whatever you want to do. And I was always involved in sports and athletics. That was really my thing. It was a big part of my life and helped me get to into a good college, good university. And like I said, I'd always had an attraction to not only just a stock market, but just to trading in general. I had a couple friends of mine, again, that one of my good friends, half of his family, they had been in the grain business out here in Chicago for a long, long time. So that's really how I ended up on the floor. I came on the floor and liked it. And here I am, you know, 30 years later.
So when you said you went to Pennsylvania University or University of Penn?
No, I didn't go to Penn. I went to a small school up in upstate New York called Colgate.
Yeah.
I played football. That's really, I would have never found that school. They found me.
What position did you play?
I was a center, offensive center, and, played all 4 years. I was a little too small to go pro. Two or three of my friends did go into the pro. Colgate's a 1AA program, so it's everybody there was a little too small, a little too slow. to really be, you know, Division 1A. Sometimes I thought about maybe I should have walked on to Penn State or walked on to Pitt. But even at that time, at 6'1", 230, you know, I was a little too small to be on the line. But that being said, you know, it was a great education and good football. And, you know, it was a good inroad into, you know, the possibilities that are out there. In fact, when I graduated, the only other career I really considered doing was actually being getting a master's in teaching and then being a football coach. So that was if I hadn't caught on here in Chicago, that's probably what I've done. I would have gone back and been probably a math teacher and a football coach. But you know, the way things turned out, here I am.
Here you are. So I don't know if everybody realizes just how strong high school football was in your era and in today still. The state of Pennsylvania is an incredibly rich, you just see prospects all over everywhere. I mean, I think of, you know, when you start looking at, oh, he played in Pennsylvania and he played in Pennsylvania. What is it about the state in high school football? We think Nebraska or Iowa or Illinois, you know, we've got a good, but Pennsylvania, come on. I mean, that's first class.
Yeah, Mike Ditka, a lot of good players came out of the Western Pennsylvania. Amazing. And I don't know what it is between there and Ohio. Oh, again, I grew up in the 80s. I graduated high school in 84, college in 88. That's when, you know, Moeller and Cincinnati, that they just had those powerhouse programs. Quite a few players, you know, came out of that area. I don't know what it is, something in the water. You know, I think it was the first football game I remember watching was 1972 or 73, the Steelers. And I was lucky because I came of age during, you know, when the Steelers really were incredible. And, you know, that was back in the day where it wasn't really that hard to go to a football game. It wasn't, you know, a $300 or a $400 deal. And, you know, a couple times a year we would go see the Steelers play. And certainly it was a huge part of Western Pennsylvania's culture.
Yeah. Do you watch football today and do you go, wow, those centers really have to do a lot more reading than I did?
You know what? It hasn't changed that much, but I still watch it. I watch it like I'm an offensive coordinator. A couple of my friends that I played with in college were coached through the NFL, so I'll try and watch them as well. At the end of the day, it comes down to, you know, getting your head on somebody and making sure that you stay with the block. It's not that complicated. When you watch the NFL, these teams struggle. 90% of it comes down to what's going on the line of scrimmage. They don't get a lot of, you know, glory and a lot of attention. Although today, probably one of the highest paid positions is left tackle in the NFL because you're protecting the quarterback's blindside. But, you know, certainly back in the 70s and 80s, the offensive line, defensive line really wasn't the glory position. It was always the quarterback and the running backs.
Despite playing at Colgate, a home game, what was the best road venue to play at? When you were in college, what one was the most picturesque or the fans were the best that you really loved to go in and compete and maybe steal a game?
Every year I was there for the 4 years, we played Army, and there's nothing like going to West Point. If anybody out there, if you ever get a chance to go up to Hudson, the Hudson Valley there, it's just absolutely amazing. And we would go there in the fall. That's when leaves are changing. But I think 2 of the 3 years we played them, it was their homecoming. So it was just a really special event at the time. Actually, my senior year was the last time that we beat them. A couple years ago, Colgate had an undefeated team. I actually got on a plane and flew back and watched the Army-Colgate game, and Army won. But I'd say in all my 4 years, that was the place that I most liked going to. It was really beautiful. And then the flip side of that is, I'd say the other venue I liked going to, or the game that I remember the most, is we played Syracuse. And Syracuse at the time was a pretty big powerhouse, so it was nice to be a smaller school to go play Syracuse. They did beat us, but that was a good memory playing in the Carrier Dome, which, again, in mid-'80s, that was a big deal to go into a dome stadium. So those are my two fondest memories. But, yeah, if I'd say this, I'd recommend it to anybody. If you've never been to West Point, it's worth the road trip.
I've heard Dan Patrick talk about it on his radio show time and time again. And so I've Googled photos to see, well, what's he talking about? And I'm like, oh, it is an incredible setting there in upstate New York. And you just got to make it. Well, we'll get you into Iowa here real soon, and we'll get you on Market to Market. We have, as this comes out, we're just a few days away from having you back on. It'll be your second time. We look forward to getting you into Johnston and breaking down all these markets. Chris Robinson, thank you so much, and look forward to talking to you soon.
Thanks a lot. Have a great one.
If you have any feedback for me, hit me up, markettomarket@iowapbs.org. I'm Paul Yeager. Thank you so very much for listening.